The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good afternoon, everybody. Is everyone in from outside, too? I want to start up our next panel, and we are very fortunate to have a great group here. But before we get started, I just really want to send out a congratulations to SDLP, who has just continued to evolve into a premier journal through the work of Kelly, Maria, Carrie, other people on the staff currently, Kirk, and the past editors-in-chief. Going back, I've just watched over the years the progress in this publication, and they all should really be proud of what they're doing here at AU, and it makes me feel really good as an alumni participating in this school that it continues to really evolve into a premier environmental program. So for me, thank you. The topic for this presentation and panel was stated as, how can U.S. law impact the international community and engage developing countries? I want to throw out the option here to our panelists and kind of flip that, because we haven't done anything yet here on a national level. And I want to take a look at, how can the systems that currently exist, like the EU ETS, which Mr. Donkers will speak to, how can they impact the U.S. legislation? And we take lessons learned from what has happened already in a test case, in the CDM process, in other experiences. How can that help us develop better legislation here in the U.S., not losing the developing country aspects, but we already have a lot of experience emerging in the CDM process and in the transitional economies with the JI process. What can we learn from these programs as we develop the offset mechanisms that may accompany any U.S. program that goes on? So I wanted you guys to have the flexibility in your presentation to look at that. We dealt with a concept of patchwork a couple times in the first session today. And I think that's really important as we look at this as a global discussion, because there are market mechanism systems emerging all over the world, not just in Europe, but in Australia, in Taiwan, we see evidence going on. In Japan, they have a voluntary system that is, quote, really not voluntary, that's emerging. Canada is developing its system. We need to figure out if there is ultimately going to be linkages here, how do we ensure that there is integrity in each of these systems so that the common denominator is pulled up? How do we make sure that monitoring, reporting, verification, these type of issues are solid so that there's confidence for these systems to communicate and work together? We're very fortunate today to have a panel that's made up of diverse perspectives. At first, I thought this was going to be a real challenge to kind of try to tie this together. But then when I really thought about it, we have a representative who will speak about experience from industry and an example through the aviation industry. We have Charles DeLeva here from the World Bank, who's project finance and development assistance. Nasser is going to give us a civil society perspective, and Mr. Donkers from a global government perspective. And it's going to be important for us to focus that this is a huge, huge challenge. Each one of these constituencies needs to be heard, needs to be represented if we want to make these systems work and to communicate and work together. Without much further ado, I think we're going to start with Rob Donkers here to kick off the discussion and try to educate us here in the U.S. on the success and trials and tribulations of what was a pilot project. But Europe acted. They did something to get the process moving. So I don't really think it's fair for us to necessarily just put up charts and show how markets collapsed or allocations were done inappropriately. They have learned a lot of lessons that we should be taking to heart right now and starting the discussion with that. Mr. Donkers is the counselor for environmental affairs at the delegation of the European Commission in Washington, D.C. Rob?
thanks very much, and thanks to the organizers for putting up this panel and having me as part of the panel. Being European, we are always very straightforward, but I live now 4 years in the United States, so I know you can handle it. I think it's a little bit premature to discuss the impact of US legislation on the international community. Indeed, as Ken said, there's nothing yet. And if we heard listen carefully to what both Marks have been saying on the previous panel, not for the time being we will be expecting something. So I'm not going to give you a commercial on the European policy. I will just slip in a few of the commercials here and there. I'm not going to give you a lecture either on how the EU trading is working in Europe, but I'm happy to answer questions on that. What I have been trying to do in a few slides, and I'm afraid I can't even read them from here, let alone you will, but hopefully they will be distributed after the discussion, is to see what kind of circumstances, what kind of conditions, big words, may be, they may have to be met if the US climate legislation will have a positive impact on the international community. Because it doesn't say in the question for the panel whether it has to be positive or negative. But I'm always optimistic, so I hope to address a few of the optimistic parts. Now, first we have then to realize, and that's also a remark which I would like to make compared to the in relation to the first panel, David Hunter tried. Fine, we're talking cost, we're talking do we have a tax, do we have a carbon trade, or potentially not a mix. But we don't even know where we're going. We in Europe, but again, that's us, we first want to define where we have to go. We look at the science and we say, hey folks, this is going very bad. If we don't do something, and we don't do something very serious, we'll be in big trouble. And then we say, how can we avoid this, and how can we avoid it in the most efficient way? What I hear here in the United States, and also here in the first panel, you're already designing the car, you don't even know where the road is. You need first to know what the problem is and to see what are the challenges, and then you know whether you have an off-road car or just a car for shopping in the city, etc. So, and then if you look at the international community, you have to be aware what you have been doing as a US and Europe, so the developed world, in terms of our contribution, so our moral obligation in terms of historical emissions and current emissions. And the US is, in 2000, that's the only chart I have, recent chart, 21%, in the meantime is 24% responsibility for the global emissions. Europe, about 14-15%. So before the world will take notice of what the US is doing, having a positive impact on what the world may think about what the US is doing, you better realize that you are the biggest emitter in town. And it will only be worse in future. This is the trend for the US and for the EU. Now forget about the EU for the moment. Look at your graph, part of the graph, US. You will be going up with current policies, 1% in greenhouse gas emissions per year, and this is only a chart until 2010. You will be, at the moment, the US is about 18% above 1990 levels. We started about the same level, EU and the US, in 1990. US is going up 1% per year, and this is projected by the Department of Energy to continue until 2030, and then you will be around 34% above 1990 levels. So if we are talking US legislation, and I will show another version of the chart you saw already previously with all the proposals for on the Hill, I think we have to set those proposals against what is the real reality in the real world and what are the predictions. And these are not made by some nasty people in Europe or so. These are done by the United Nations.
Well.
You may have to find them nasty as well, I don't know. What I think, and then that hopefully will trigger some discussions, I think there's only a positive impact likely coming from US positions, policies, legislation, if indeed the US is ready to recognize the science and draw conclusions and will come forward with a credible basis for negotiations internationally. We are not looking at the U.S. anymore, unfortunately, in the environment field as we did in the 60s and 70s, where car emission standards and other standards were just gratefully accepted everywhere around the world. You're old stuff. You haven't been keeping up with the rest of the world in developing. Take the fuel efficiency of cars. You're still at the same level as in the 70s. In Europe, we are 45 miles per gallon. And China will be also very soon. You are about 26, 25. So if you really want to have an impact on the rest of the world and engage in developing countries, you better be good and show the example again. And that's what we admire about the United States. You always want, and in a lot of cases you have, the moral higher ground. Not on this issue. So if you want to have an impact, you better come with something decent. And for instance, I mean, I'm coming now from negotiations with the United States government for the end of April summit between the European Union and the United States. The United States government is not interested at all to engage with developing world. It's not interested at all to engage with European Union. They don't want to negotiate an international agreement. 2012 is not our problem, that's part of Kyoto. That kind of language is what you hear from the U.S. government. I applaud very much what's happening at state level, don't get me wrong, and the U.S. CAP, I'm really very, very pleased with what's happening by industry, some industry at least, and other stakeholders. But you have to do something about the government's position. And it's not Bush, don't get me wrong, I'm not here against this administration. Clinton didn't do, and Gore, by the way, didn't do something either, other than negotiating Kyoto and then not putting it to Congress. So I'm in that sense quite neutral as a European. And most of the good state initiatives are, by the way, done by Republican governors. So in that sense, I'm completely neutral here. Now, if there is another advice I may give, modestly, in terms of getting a positive impact, yes, if you are developing a U.S. Trading scheme, for God's sake, don't put a price cap. No linking will be possible. Do you think we're going to link our allowances with a system which has a price cap? Forget it. If you choose for a market instrument, let the market decide. Yes, we had a lot of volatility last year. You saw the chart Mark put up during our initial and still going on trial period in our emission trading scheme. Why? Exactly as was said, I think, by Nadia. We didn't have an historical, not a good enough historical database on greenhouse gas emissions. We knew that. So we took the risk of allowing more, but the result is that at the moment this allowance is only $1 worth, or $1.30. But we also were not that stupid. When the thing starts in the second period next year, January, no allowances can be banked into the next period. They will be completely useless. And the trading, virtual trading for the allowances for the period 2008-2012 is $13-14. So please don't price, no price cap. And again, what I got from a lot of discussions here in the country and also from the previous panel, it's good to have a renewable portfolio. We also try that, and I will show that in a second. It's good to focus on energy efficiency, but also you have to realize what that means. A lot of people here have laptops. They are much more energy efficient than a couple of years ago. Same goes for TV sets or refrigerators. But what is our trend? We have two TV sets, three TV sets, four TV sets in one family. Do you think that's energy efficient? No. Yes, per unit, yes, but not for the family. So I think we also have to have something between the ears then in terms of behavioral changes if we want to be energy efficient. And that brings me to another point. What I hear always in the United States, but also in a lot of parts of Europe, not that much different, is, yeah, okay, we replace then coal and oil and something else by renewables or nuclear, etc. So we're only looking at the supply side. We're not looking at energy conservation. I still don't understand, both in Europe and the United States, why we're creating with air conditioning systems temperatures in summer in the malls or in the universities, which we don't accept in winter. It's all here. We can put on a shirt or pullover or whatever. So I think it's also, we don't have really a notion and I'm not better than you are, or you are not better than I am. We don't have a notion how much energy costs. Yes, it may have been going up in price because the oil prices went up, etc. Well, this is only starting. We are calculating in Europe on our programs about $100-$120 price per barrel in 10, 15 years from now. That will be the situation when China and India really will come to the markets to get oil for their economic growth. So I think we have to start thinking also in energy conservation and not just efficiency. Now, we in Europe, we have a very ambitious target because we take serious the science we are getting. And we think that we already will have a big trouble if the average temperature increase will be 2 degrees Celsius, so what is it, 3.6 Fahrenheit, which is more or less a stabilization concentration level in the atmosphere of 450 to 500 parts per million. Now, it will be a hell of a job to get there, but and until below this 2 degrees, it still will have a lot of consequence. Below, it's absolutely devastating. Now, to get there, we think we have to gradually reduce our emissions. We are now on a Kyoto target of 8% below 1990. Currently, we are 1% below. So don't believe the newspaper articles, especially not by Senator Inhofe, that we won't meet Kyoto targets, because we will meet them. And he doesn't know what he's talking about. And but we will go further. And you know why? Because we have this cap and trade. Now, you can have a lot of discussions whether it's good or bad, but it's working. We had a $19 billion dollar market last year. Industry is market, the market instrument is working, industry is picking it up, they are getting more efficient, they are innovating, they are putting money in research, and once that wheel is starting to spin, we think without much more cost we can get to 20% reduction with a lot of efforts, of course, nothing goes for free, and then we can either go to 30, not because we like it, but because we think it's necessary to not get to this 2 degree, or at least not beyond. And we want the U.S. to share this goal, because otherwise we will get way beyond 2 degrees if the U.S. is going to continue the path it has, as I showed already on the previous graph. But of course the developing countries have to do something as well, because if we are doing a lot, the U.S. is doing a lot, and they just unlimitedly can grow and be very inefficient, then of course there's no point that we are doing it as well. So one of the big things we want to achieve is engage the developing countries in a new international agreement, of which I just said the US government is not interested, but still complaining about the developing countries. And have them growing, but in a more energy efficient way than they're doing right now, until 2020, sort of. And then also they have to go down in emissions, again, within this framework of 2 degrees. And we can be much more efficient. Transport, I mentioned already the fuel efficiency. We can be much more efficient in appliances. Again, coming back to your laptops, 3 to 5% of your electricity bill is because of the standby mode of your laptops, your television sets, your VCRs, your shavers, whatever. Can be much better. Buildings. 40% of this building electricity bill goes to lighting. It can be half if you use much smarter electricity, not to mention solar, etc. And a lot of leakages are happening in the transmission of electricity and the generation of power. It can also be addressed. We want in Europe 20% more efficient by 2020 and reduce our energy consumption with 13%, so the conservation part. Now, I'm not saying that you should do the same, but economically, I'm telling you, it will be paying off. Renewables was discussed in the previous panel, so I don't have to emphasize that. We have another target for that, including also for the transport sector, 10% biofuels. And then I'm not talking the corn of Minnesota, because not necessarily the creation of biofuels with corn is environmentally friendly. We are talking second-generation biofuels and ethanol, which can also have meet environment standards. Now, I don't know whether you can see it, but this is a more upgraded version, a recent version of the proposals in the House and in the Senate, including, but it's difficult to see, the ones with Bingaman with price cap, without price cap, and then Sanders, McCain, and so on. What is striking is that in 2020, according to whatever proposal, the U.S. is not even stabilizing on 1990 levels. That is not sustainable, not for U.S. in terms of nature, not for the U.S. in terms of position on the world market, in terms of efficiency, etc. Really, really. If you want to avoid a lot of costs, then you have to do better. Not for my sake, but really for your own economy. Mark was saying, yeah, well, the cost is the most important factor. Yes, but he's forgetting that avoiding costs is probably even more important. There are enough reports published nowadays which clearly show that a dollar spent today will avoid spending $5 for the same to address the same problem a decade from now. So you also have to think as an economist, and Mark is an economist, in avoiding costs. These are then benefits which you have to you can put in your economy. Now, my conclusion. If the US legislation and the US wants to be credible again in climate issues, and again, I have full respect for what's happening at state and some other levels like industry, but I'm generalizing the US for the moment. Then again, you have to take into account all the science which is mounting up day by day and be feeling and showing responsibility to the developed world and developing countries that you really want to do something about the problem and not hiding behind the developing countries. Well, they are not doing something, we're not doing something. No, US is the world champion in emissions. I think it's about time you want to be the world champion in tackling emissions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rob. Hit on some very critical points, including behavioral change and a lot of regulations about behavioral change, but also marketing and framing and how we get ideas across to the general population, because it's going to take more than just changing industry's behavior. It's going to take consumers changing their behavior as well. So that was a very good, appreciated transition. Our next speaker is Nancy Young, who's a principal at Beveridge and Diamond, a law firm here in Washington, D.C., and by a very reliable source and also a alumni of this distinguished institution. Nancy is really the expert on emission issues as they relate to the aviation industry. So we're very privileged to have Nancy join us today and looking forward to
your presentation. Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here. I'm going to maybe give a little bit of a different perspective. As Ken already said, I'm going to focus a little bit on some of the thoughts from an industry perspective, but really the challenge posed to this panel was sort of where are we going globally and how do we kind of link up what is happening in Congress, what's happening in the states that we learned about a little bit before, with what's going on in the global economy. And so I'm going to sort of focus on really the factors that we need to grapple with in really the next era. I think that there is furious consensus among the panel members and from seeing some of your reactions today that really climate change policy is here. And I think, as one of the panelists earlier said, it's not a question really of whether anymore. It's really a question of how. And I refer to this really phenomenon as the climate change currency. And that word maybe has a couple of different meanings. One is, you know, currency, like spendable money, tradable things. The other one is it's very current. I mean, we're and very now. What are the drivers for those? Well, we've touched on those, I think, throughout the panels today. But the first one, I'm going to provide a little bit more overview on to kind of set up the global scene, and that is obviously the laws. I mean, we're being driven by agreement, first at sort of the treaty level, but then also at a federal level or a regional level in the case of the European Union. And the state level here in the United States, and even some municipalities have come into it. So what's going on there? We know, obviously, that the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change went into force in 1994. The U.S. and lots of other countries are signatories to that, and we all agreed that it was important to find ways to address greenhouse gas emissions. So I don't think that that's in dispute. The Kyoto Protocol then went into force in 2005, and only a set of countries agreed to that, and most notably, I think the U.S. Has declined to agree to that. Something important to think about the future with Kyoto is, as already mentioned, the targets in the Kyoto Protocol really are 2008 to 2012. And we're in 2007 now. So what we really need to be thinking about, you can continue to debate about whether the U.S. should enter the Kyoto Protocol, but I think what we're really looking at is what happens after that first Kyoto period. And I refer to that as the son or daughter of Kyoto. So some of my remarks are really, what are the principles that we need to tackle when we come to the son and daughter of Kyoto? And maybe it's a totally obvious thing, but those are the same issues that Congress has to grapple with when it's thinking about what do we as a domestic economy do about these issues. So yes, there's law, and yes, there's policy driving this, but I think the inevitability really comes from, you know, it's sort of a chicken and egg question. I think now there are other markets on board with climate change policy that are going to drive this, that are driving this. And one of them is the financial market. Again, to get to the change currency concept, you just have to go to any number of meetings that all of these folks and I go to, or you just have to go to Wall Street and talk to somebody, and you see the level of excitement that there is a new commodity that they can trade, that there is a new financial instrument that we can play with. And that probably doesn't get at your or anybody's idealistic views of, oh, you know, we need to save the planet, but it's a very strong force when the financial market picks it up and says, we think we can make money off of this, and we're going to drive it that way. So maybe there are ways that those interests, those financial interests and the sort of save the planet interests come together with that phenomenon. The other aspect, and it's been mentioned a little bit today, and it's of great interest to industry, and it really is where one of the big dividing lines in industry is right now, which is the market for control technologies. And if you are General Electric and you own a lot of the patents for the control technologies, or if you are a company that believes that you have ways of switching fuels or sequestering carbon or the like, then you're very pro for a number of these types of policies. Again, not just because of Save the Planet, that's a big one, but also because you think that that puts you in a better market advantage than other industry. And so that is inevitably driving this as well. And this whole research and development for new technology, you know, now that we've conquered the computer as, you know, everybody owns one, now we need to conquer the, you know, the CO2 sequestration market or whatever to have a new era of technology. Finally, and it's imbued through all of the things I've mentioned so far and what everybody's talked about, it's public opinion. It's been changing. And that kind of swirls together and makes all of this inevitable as well. It's taken on kind of what I would say is a Hollywood sort of air as well, with an Al Gore Academy Awards thing, with Bono and concerts, and it's taking on with Richard Branson, who I'll talk about a little bit more, in the aviation industry, you know, really taking on these issues. And, you know, maybe, I don't know what you guys talk about these days, but I know, you know, some people talk about Tom Cruise's wedding or whatever. Climate change has really gotten to that level of everyday conversation for people, and that is part of the currency. I will date myself while I change the slide here, or try to change the slide, and note that when I was in sort of late 60s, you know, and 8-year-old, 10-year-old kid, and the Give a Hoot, Don't Pollute campaign came out in the United States, which was, you know, our first way of expressing that for everybody at every level, at every age, that we needed to do something about the environment. I think we're seeing a lot of that same type of grassroots approach right now to climate change. You know this, you read the paper, you've heard people talk about it, but I put up on this slide a couple of the different interests that are out there, because I think this defines what do we have to tackle internationally and domestically as we go forward in the new legislative regimes. President Bush, two big issues he raises. What about developing countries? That's a big issue. Another one that he raises is, how do we do this without harming the economy? Something that Prime Minister Blair raises, which a lot of other folks raise as well, is we need to set targets at a level that are going to make a difference. And the Kyoto Protocol is a start, but there's a lot more that will need to be done. Then you have developing nations, the quote up that I have up there, where it's sort of a mixed bag. These are important issues, but many of them view it as an opportunity for economic growth. And I'm not going to get into the mechanisms, the clean development mechanism and the like, that allow that, because I know another panelist is going to do that. But it's an important thing out there, and also the view of the developing countries, that the developed countries already had their, you know, or used up their quota, and so the developing countries still should be able to do, generate more greenhouse gas emissions and not be subject to these types of limits. I just put up another quote from the Petroleum Refiners Association, because it raises what we haven't really talked about much today, which is, where is the science? And what I would venture is, for me, I've seen it change from, it's hokey and nobody knows what the science is, to, I want to know the specific science about my industry's sector effect on the greenhouse gas problem, so that I only have to do my fair share. And I think that is really an important part of what's going to happen internationally and domestically, in terms of how do you come up with a cap and trade system, or how do you come up with a carbon tax system that deals with that issue. Okay, I'm proving how technically inept I am. Everybody else did better with this. So before getting into the sub-elements of sort of what do we have to tackle internationally and domestically, I just want to throw out a premise, and it's totally pandering to the audience, but it's totally true. I mean, we're here talking about sustainable development law and policy. Well, to deal with some of the challenges that you have with the previous slide, I said this very disparate approach. What about economy? What about developing nations? What about my industry? How do I make money off of this? With that, is there a principle that we could all agree to that would help us come up with a fundamental way forward? And I think, in my view, that the principle that industry can get behind, that government should be able to get behind, and the people should be able to get behind, is sustainability. And okay, that's easy to say. But what is sustainability? The idea is that development today should be done in a way that meets the needs for today, but without compromising the future. That is, if some people will say, well, that means that you have to, you know, have no environmental impact now because our sons and daughters are gonna feel that. That is not really the way that that concept has come to be understood. It's come to be understood as a balancing of social, economic, and environmental factors. And it really brings into this issue, how do you tackle climate change without ruining the economy and without creating perverse effects? How do you decide in the United States we're gonna do something to the steel industry that doesn't just export the problem to another country? And so by looking at it in a sustainability framework, you can really try to get your arms around that, thinking we need to balance the social, environmental, and economic good here. Oh, going the wrong way now. Yep, definitely going the wrong way. Okay. one of the things that, that Ken had suggested we might want to focus on is, okay, we're one of the issues is the U.S. is doing its thing, Europe's doing its thing, and all that. How do we link these together, and is there a value in linking these together? And this is part of the what is the future for the U.S. And for the various international regimes. And one answer would be you don't have to link them at all. We can do our thing, the Europeans can do their things, and the like. That would be a huge lost opportunity, and probably would not work at the end of the day. I put up a few reasons why here. One, I mean, to really have a carbon currency, you really need to make it a global type of approach. You need to address the economies of scale that you can get through that. Also, the issues that I think Mark raised earlier, if you just do it without linking these systems up and without sort of a set of fundamental agreements, then you're going to have market distortion. And then the next issue that I've had a prelude to is there are also a couple of industries that are truly international, like aviation, where if you don't deal with the linkages between the systems, you know, what are you going to do? Stop flying your plane in the middle of the air because another country has a different set of rules? So we've got to deal with that. And I wanted to use that as a kind of a case study for what are these issues. And I think the issues are pretty much the same again. They're the same in the aviation industry as they are in Congress, and they're the same in Congress as they are on an international level. And that is the issues that we have to get our arms around are the extent of an individual industry's contribution, and that, I would, as I said earlier, would be making sure the science is capable of getting us enough, not certainty, but enough comfort level that we can figure out who should be doing what, how to address the competition between developed and developing states, and in the international aviation industry, one of the issues here is the developing states have no targets under Kyoto, and yet Brazil, China, and India and Singapore have like the fourth, sixth, and eighth or whatever biggest civil aviation powers in the world. I mean, they're very, very competitive. And so they would be exempt on a certain flight that somebody, a European carrier, would not be exempt on if we don't deal with that kind of issue. Also, as I noted, how to address the linkages between these systems. The aviation industry poses this challenge. We've got a domestic industry and we've got an international industry. How do you link those together, much less how do you link the United States system with the European system? One final point on that, too, is you need to figure out, I think, and I really liked what Rob said, there is a range of measures that you have to think about. It's not just what do you do to industry, but how do you get technology and other things coming to play? I'm going to do two more minutes on the international aviation industry to kind of queue up those issues for thought, and I hope we come back to them in the question series. But to be specific about why I think the aviation industry is a good case study is under the Kyoto Protocol, the existing agreement says, well, we don't quite know how to deal with international aviation because of these competitions and all competition issues and all that. So let's have the International Civil Aviation Organization, ICAO, a United Nations body, figure out a plan for that. And so the Kyoto Protocol says that. And it sets it up in a way that ICAO is supposed to figure out what happens with international aviation emissions, and the United States is supposed to figure out what happens with its domestic aviation emissions, and individual European states are supposed to figure out what happens with their domestic emissions and the like. Well, you can just imagine the possibilities of problems with that. I'm going to skip that slide. One of the ways that the European Union has come up with to deal with that issue is this emissions trading system that they're doing now. And in the absence of an agreement at the international level, ICAO has not agreed to really a way forward. In the absence of that, The European Commission has said we want to include international aviation in our scheme. And the proposal right now that is being considered within their legislature is coverage of EU and non-EU carriers on the entire flight in their system. So if you took off from New York, the United States does not have any of these types of policies. ICAO has not said you must do this type of policy. If you took off from New York and flew to a European country, that would be covered by an emissions trading regime, and the airline would have to offset its emission. We are headed to a trade war over that issue if the Europeans finalize it. Without taking a position on whether it's the right approach or not, what I would say is it really raises these international arguments. The U.S. opposes mandatory measures, so they can't agree to it, at least not now. Some Kyoto countries have said our industries, our aviation industry, we're not going to do a mandatory system for, and they're not happy about having the Europeans decide that for them. And as I noted before, the developing states think that they should be exempt. So to finish up, or not, what do you do about that? And basically, I come back to what I think the solutions are on a domestic basis, on a national, an international basis, and on an industry basis for aviation, which is you need to have increased consensus about drilling down to specific industries about what their contribution is. You need agreement on how to address developing states. You need agreement on architecture of linkages, and you need sustainability or a concept like that to underpin all of this so that you bring in technology, you bring in sort of what is the right economic cost and the right environmental benefit to that. And with that, I'm going to conclude, and hopefully we'll get to chat a little bit more and questions.
Thanks, Nancy. It was really great to hear the sort of case study perspective from a particular industry and how we may expand that and apply to other industries. And we look forward to coming back and also some of the other issues that may come up with linkages, including creating efficiencies for multinationals and large institutions. Our next speaker is Nasir Hattak, who is the Director of Global Environment Programs at the Climate Institute, and will offer us a little different perspective, more from the civil society perspective, on how to mitigate climate change.
Thank you very much, Ken, and thank you. I thank the organizers for inviting us. I'll present a perspective on how to engage the developing world by sharing our experience. Climate Institute is an NGO, international NGO. We've been around for 20 years. Probably not too many NGOs were talking about climate at that point. So I'll quickly go over a little bit of background, try to scare everyone a little bit more. Not a lot of science. People didn't talk much about science. And I'm not a scientist. I'm not a lawyer, an engineer, but I'm working on some projects overseas. So, but we have some good scientists, and they tell us that what IPCC is telling us is not enough. I mean, there's more to it. And it is not counting the Greenland ice melting. So I wanted to show you some pictures, which will come later. So the point is that it is a serious problem. And it's not only the small island states in Bangladesh and other countries, but you know, the coastal areas of the United States are also at risk. I don't want to go too much into science, but just this slide I brought shows 1992 and 2002, the ice sheets from Greenland. And last time when everything melted, it was, I think, 15 or 20 meters sea level rise. So we may be heading towards a bigger catastrophe than we all have been thinking about. and science is not completely there to 100% conclude on it, and IPCC also involves governments to sign on it, so it cannot include everything because all the governments has to sign on it, including the U.S. So this talks about the U.S. also will have coastal areas under threat. The challenge, this slide gives an overview and says the technological economic aspects of the problem are not quite as challenging as many imagine. The basic difficulty is that it is a global problem, and every country's interest is to get every other country to bear the burden of tackling it. And because it is long-term, it is every generation's interest to shrink the responsibility and shift it to the next one. So I wanted to share this, just a quick one. And also, the climate change will not treat world's nations equally. The vulnerability of different countries varies according to their sensitivity to the climate change. And one last thing is the vulnerability index derived analyzing dependence on exports, isolation distance, and sensitivity. According to that, developing countries on average twice and small island states three times more vulnerable as industrialized country. And I'll show some examples of our working with small island states and why we decided to work with the island states, so we can maybe make a case and encourage the and influence the international negotiations. And awareness is important. As this cartoon says, that why don't the greenhouse gases escape through the hole in the ozone layer? So there's still a lot of people not clear about it. And Al Gore is doing, I think, a very fine job of raising public awareness, and hopefully from bottom up, the public will influence their policymakers, and they will come to realization. What we try to promote is, yes, Kyoto and all these mechanisms are important and they are necessary, but much more needs to be done if we really want to stabilize the emissions. And it is not impossible. I mean, we had a conference in Seattle a few years ago where we brought the IT industry entrepreneurs and tried to draw parallels between how the computer and the IT industry has progressed. And if we compare the computer, which would occupy the whole room, and now a small laptop that a child can operate has the same capacity. So technology can bring, and innovation is where we see possibility of stabilizing the emissions. And all these other mechanisms are definitely going to make an impact on pushing those innovative strategies. And our approach has been to work with developing countries and identify ways of collaboration and cooperation, cooperative programs between the developed and developing countries. And I'll give some examples of that. And in the U.S., we try to bridge the policymaking and the scientific community, the information of science, to pass it on to the politicians, which doesn't necessarily work all the time, but a combination of the bottom-up approach that Al Gore and others are doing, hopefully that is going to bring some change. And I had the title of my presentation also, the How to Engage Developing Countries, the three things that we believe are necessary as action and partnership and leadership. So, I mean, it's not rocket science. When United States moves, everybody notices, and when they talk, it makes a huge difference. So without U.S. taking the leadership and taking the action, it's not going to happen. So the world is, obviously waiting to see what U.S. is going to do. And after that, we can talk about engaging the developing countries. And just want to elaborate more on the win-win opportunities. There are many ways where you could do economic development, energy efficiency, renewable energy, and reducing air pollution, at the same time you reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So those are the win-win opportunities for developing world that we try to promote through our projects. If the developed countries would also help the developing countries in looking at the development rather than talking about reducing their emissions, and then finding those win-win opportunities and show them that by doing so, they can also achieve the results that we all want to have. So India's and China's, I believe, will be able to stabilize their emissions as well if it is handled carefully and tactfully and through leadership and through partnership. There's a lot of detail, but I'm just trying to give some broad ideas that, you know, we have learned based on, you know, our work. We have worked with small island states, which are the most vulnerable to the effects of climate change, sea level rise, extreme weather conditions, and there are 43 small island states in the UN system, and they form alliance of small island states. They have a much louder voice than many other developing countries because they have 42 votes when it comes to treaties and other international agreements. The point that we picked was because at the same time, I mean, they're most vulnerable to the effects of climate change, at least responsible because the emissions are negligible, but they have also natural resources. I mean, they're sitting on wind resources, solar, in many cases, geothermal, hydro. So we began working with a bunch of small island states in the Caribbean. The first island was St. Lucia. And the Prime Minister agreed and announced at one of the climate change conferences that we want to become a sustainable energy demonstration country. And we started working with them to develop a plan where they would switch from 100% diesel-based power system to a clean energy system based on their local natural resources of geothermal, wind, solar, and energy efficiency measures and awareness of, for conservation. And they're on their way now in the implementation phase, and we have developed sustainable energy plans for four others in the Caribbean and two in the Pacific. So we're calling it a global sustainable energy islands program, where we are trying to show that these are small countries taking steps to reduce their emissions, and the bigger countries should help them achieve their goal and also follow their example. But when we talk to the island states, we tell them it's for your economic development. It makes economic sense to use wind and solar and geothermal because you have the natural resource. Why import diesel? Similarly, there are many other ways in bigger countries also. We have started now a Green States initiative where we will be matching U.S. states and developing country states, because sometimes the states have more resources and capacity to work on climate change programs. So we are talking to India, Pakistan, Mexico, Brazil, and Indonesia. So trying to find those leaders. And there are, at state level, the governors, general public, awareness is there. And the same strategies that work here also work there. It's just shouldn't be, you know, getting stuck in those political and other legal debates that happen. I mean, they will continue, but we need to keep taking action and build those partnerships between universities, between the public and organizations, and those in the businesses and the industry, to find those win-win opportunities. And that's how we are going to achieve the goals that we are trying to achieve. I don't want to talk about our programs any further. I guess the message is that the movie I saw, which I saw it very late, and I like it, it repeats a few times in that movie that with great powers come great responsibilities. So I will leave it at that.
That's great, Nasser. Thank you very much. And looking at these win-wins is really very important. Never underestimate the power of a smaller demonstration that can be scaled up, like the St. Lucia example that you presented. and we'll come back to some of those issues. I think there's a lot of common ground that was laid out in this presentation related to innovation, technology, and other issues that everyone on this panel could agree on. So thank you. Last but not least is Charles DeLeva, who is the Chief Counsel of the Environmentally and Socially Sustainable Development and International Law Practice
of
the World Bank.
We're in the process.
Charles has a long and a very great history in being really central to many of the leading international environmental issues through his work at the UN and as head of the Commission on Environmental Law for IUCN, and now in his position at the World Bank. We're honored to have you here, Chuck.
Thanks. It's good to follow Nasser, because I think what he's talking about doing projects with developing countries is the essence of what the World Bank tries to do. It's maybe worth just restating for this audience that the World Bank is not only perhaps the world's largest international financial institution, but it's also a United Nations specialized agency. So with that responsibility, it applies not only to weaving webs like Spider-Man, but trying to connect money that comes from the developed world with the needs in the developing world. And that's been the case very much for the World Bank since its creation in 1945. With the emergence of environmental and social issues, especially in the, let's say, after Stockholm, but the 1980s, and then the Rio Summit in 1992, the World Bank began to be identified by the international community as having a responsibility to help, especially developing countries, implement obligations or fulfill the ideals of multilateral environmental agreements. And so one of the first things that I did when I came to the World Bank in 1992 was attend the adoption of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change in New York, at which governments referred to the World Bank and the creation of a global environment facility as a financial mechanism to help implement the objectives to address climate change. And given that many of you in the audience here will go on as careers either representing private industry or governments or NGOs or international agencies in international negotiations, I wanted to do two things. Give a little bit of background about the current political negotiations taking place with the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change and the Kyoto Protocol, and then give you a little bit about the political and financial strategy to achieve objectives to try to help developing countries go forward in addressing this particular global problem. It's worth remembering that already 15 years has passed since the global community, including the United States, agreed that there's an ultimate objective to achieve stabilization of greenhouse gases. That convention has been ratified by 190 governments. And the reference to promotion sustainable development at the same time that Nancy referred to was set out in that agreement, and that developed countries should take the lead in combating climate change. So in some sense, the political philosophy, we really haven't changed since it's 1992. These agreements still exist, but then when Kyoto was ratified in 97, we had, for the first time, internationally binding commitments to reduce greenhouse gases. I think, as the previous panel pointed out, the market mechanisms that were introduced there were those largely introduced by the United States. So it's a continuing difficulty for many who were involved in the negotiations to recognize that the party that introduced many of these principles and in essence was a leading spokesperson for them is not a party to the protocol. That's 1997. The fourth intergovernmental panel on climate change, IPCC, has spelled out now they're close to consensus of the need to address greenhouse gases. This is the scientific view today, and it's the fourth report. It shows a stronger consensus than ever before on these issues. And on the economic side, a report that Rob Donkers alluded to before, the Stern Review, done by a former chief economist at the World Bank, this was presented to the last meeting of the Conference of the Parties in Nairobi, to the Climate Change Convention and the Kyoto Protocol. And as Rob pointed out, while the economic cost for countries to achieve stabilization on a global basis is an average of 1%, if they don't, depending on where you live, how much sea level rise you're exposed to, your cost of not of the global community not doing anything can range from 5 to 20%. So the economics, the science seem compelling. And as a result, at the last meeting of the Conference of the Parties in Nairobi, just this past, we are in, what month are we in now? So it's November. They endorsed the report and they agreed they needed to work more collaboratively. Some new things were mentioned. There's an agreement that the international regime needs to accelerate the incentives for new technologies such as carbon capture and storage. Some pointed out that there's a need for a new push to address nuclear. And of special import for the World Bank, there was an agreement of a Nairobi plan of action to deal with especially sub-Saharan Africa that seems to lag far behind in receiving the needed clean energy and need to mitigate climate change impact. A legal and political anomaly that exists in this structure that is that while we had the 190 parties that ratified the Climate Change Convention, we have 166 that have ratified Kyoto. This has split the negotiations into a dialogue group, which is of the UNFCCC, and then the ad hoc working group, which represents the parties that represent Kyoto, and they can sit in different rooms at the same time negotiating many of the same issues. If we're going to implement at a global level steps to achieve the stabilization and reductions that we have been talking about today, there are certain things that we need to do to address implementation. One of the difficulties that we have is that there's no uniform global market. There are markets that are scattered. There's the Northeast States, there's California, there's the EU, there's Australian states, there's a fragmentation of markets which is preventing us from achieving what we'd like to do on a global scale. Another difficulty is captured in the fact that within this dialogue, the so-called plus five countries, China, India, Brazil, South Africa, Mexico, represent a huge share of the future emissions that will take place. They're currently without commitments under the Kyoto Protocol. But as we know, much of the political dialogue, and you see it in the quote that Rob gave from President Bush, is this sense of the need for the U.S. to move forward dependent upon bringing in the plus five countries. And so you hear the frequent reference to China surpassing the U.S. in greenhouse gas emissions in the very near future. So given this impasse, this political impasse, how can we move forward at the global level? Well, there was one proposal, maybe the UN Secretary General should convene a head of state summit at the United Nations, because the negotiations tend to be generally, delegations are headed at a ministerial level. It may be an environment ministry. It may be foreign affairs, but it's not heads of state. And perhaps we can agree on certain principles to progress. One thing that's referred to is perhaps if it's not meaningful commitments that come from the plus five countries, maybe we can engage in the concept of meaningful participation. Maybe this is something that's politically palatable to the United States. If that's the case, it's probably worth pointing out that China has already spent $7 billion on renewable energy. China's also passed a new law on renewable energy sources. They have automobile standards now that have surpassed the United States. The EU has recently made its pledge to even further commitments. And these kinds of commitments may help us proceed in a global dialogue toward some sort of political consensus that's currently not existing. At the same time that we recognize that the political commitments may take time, what can financial institutions like the World Bank do to try to help the poor of the world that still are without access in many cases to electricity? There's still some 2 billion people in the world that do not have access to electricity. And very often, the argument is juxtaposed that to achieve that access to electricity, one has to accept the continued use of access to traditional energy sources. And sometimes that's viewed as a win-lose proposition, access but environmental damage. How can you try to overcome that hurdle? One of the things that the World Bank has been trying to do is support a transition in poorer countries to a low-carbon economy. It's recognized by the World Bank's Clean Energy Investment Framework that this is going to require mobilization of significant resources. The example that Nasser gave about St. Lucia making a transition to wind and solar is one that everyone supports, and the one that everyone would view in the long term as also being economically sound. But where do you get the upfront costs to enable them to make that transition from the readily available diesel generator that's been there for 30, 40 years to bringing in the new technology? How do you buy down that new technology? And the risk is that if you don't, most capital stock in the energy field is usually stock that exists for 30 to 50 years. So if in the next few years we don't start making this transition to clean energy, we lose even more time to catch the curve and start bending the curve of emissions downward. So in many ways, the time to act now is now, and to mobilize capital is now. And a major element of this strategy is, instead of looking at the St. Lucia project as, let's, in the World Bank, find a way to bring $5 million from a German fund into St. Lucia and replace the, give a name, the Three Seasons resort of St. Lucia from diesel to solar and help them convert. And then sell the emission reductions back to Germany so they can help meet their targets under Kyoto. What if instead of doing that, we look at St. Lucia or the Caribbean as a whole, and if we say that instead of focusing on this one particular project, we deal with all resorts. We deal with the whole tourism sector of the Caribbean, and we get as a whole the sector to agree, maybe through the Ministry of Tourism or the Ministry of Energy. If we get the whole sector to agree that there's going to be a shift in 3 to 5 years of all hotels, all diesel facilities at tourism sites to solar and wind, then we start to talk about achieving the kind of scale that we need to in order to address the demand that's so needed at this stage. So, what we need to do is to help the world of carbon finance grow. And as we've been talking about perspectives here, we started in the World Bank before the Kyoto Protocol with a prototype carbon fund. We were just doing one project with several cities in Mexico where, with funding from the Norwegian government, Japanese government, we helped several cities change from standard fluorescent lighting to high compact lighting. And we calculated the greenhouse gases that we saved from that project. That was ahead of the whole clean development mechanism that was created under the Kyoto Protocol. What we've done since is create an accumulated $2 billion in funds, in carbon funds, largely supported by EU governments and Japan and the private sector in Europe and Japan, and used the funds from those nine funds that we managed to carry out projects like the type that Nasser was describing. And that type of activity that we've done has all been geared to the Kyoto Protocol through 2012. What we're facing now is that Kyoto is expiring. And what needs to take place in order for the incentive to continue to finance these kinds of projects that switch from coal to solar, from diesel to natural gas, to make these fuel switches, is the market needs to know that there's going to be some form of regulatory certainty post 2012. That's why there's an urgency to the negotiations that are taking place in Kyoto. I think that's in part why, I can't speak for the European Union, but I think that's in part why they've given the signal to go forward, that they're making commitments post 2012 and to increase their commitments and what one needs to see in the political discussions going forward. So I'll leave it at that so we have some time for questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Charles. We're going to have a few minutes to take some questions. I know that we've been pushed at 5:45, but I understand maybe there's a little bit of flexibility that we can go on. So, because we have a good discussion here, I know there's even some questions from panelists to other panelists that or responses that people would like to make, and I know you all have some questions while we have this group up here. So, being first and being the loudest whispering in my ear, Rob Donkers wants to make a brief little, I guess, response to the presentation on aviation, and I'd like to open it up to the floor after Nancy has a chance to respond to Rob.
I didn't say anything controversial, did I, Rob?
He's got something. I don't know.
Didn't say any controversial.
Just said some people disagreed.
The only thing is that you weren't complete. First of all, let me see. Your quote on Bush, of course, is not your fault, but the problem is Bush is not right. 80% of the population is not world population exempt Kyoto. They are party, as also Charles has just alluded to. Only the US insisted during the negotiation that they shouldn't have targets in the first period. So I think it's a bit perverse remark to drop out of Kyoto because of the fact that you insisted yourself that you didn't want them to have commitments. But anyway, on aviation, the story here is that ICAO can only do something with unanimity. And with a government like the U.S. blocking any reasonable outcome of ICAO, you can't expect other countries to just wait and sit and wait until there's a new administration in the United States. So we come with our proposal. We want to have rules in ICAO, yes, of course. And one of the reasons why we come with a proposal is to see whether we can fuel the thing a little bit up. And the second thing is, if a country, Nancy was right, the two legs will be in our system. Unless a country, let's say the departing flight country, is having similar or compatible measures. Then we do only our outbound part. So I want just to make that point because we are not monopolizing the aviation part here. First of all, we think that it is a reasonable thing to also include the aviation sector, which in Europe is taking up 25% of reductions which are created by other sectors. That is not a credible story in Europe. And secondly, we can work with ICAO as long as there will be an agreement.
But in sort of an unusual circumstance, I actually wasn't saying that you were wrong. I was saying that a number of countries beg to differ with that approach, and I think it really underscores the challenge that we face internationally going forward. That, you know, part of what's going on there is dealing with the developing nations issue. Part of it is dealing with the United States, where it's going to go with its legislation. So, your politics can be whatever they may be. I will add for the record, though, that the European states and the European Commission opposed ICAO continuing to discuss in parallel with whatever you guys might be doing, an ICAO-based worldwide solution. And, we will disagree about that.
We will continue to disagree about it. The proposal by the Commission is not law.
It could have been done in parallel with whatever you guys are doing, and you guys voted against it.
You're just firing it up.
Good. I'd love to be part of the continued debate here, but we're going to move on and see if we have some questions from the audience. I have a hand being raised over here. Would you like to start us off? Microphone. You got to stand up. You're in law school. Come on.
Do some energy.
Sure. I mean, if I understand your question, how can aviation do better? Is that it's a really difficult issue because, as you point out, an asset like an aircraft is extremely has a long economic life and is extremely expensive. That said, the aviation industry has been extremely motivated to be as fuel efficient as possible within their means because, as you guys probably know, I mean, save the planet is everybody's goal to some degree, but fuel is now the number one cost of airlines and has been for the last few years. And so they're very motivated to do everything that they can do to minimize fuel burn and hence minimize greenhouse gas emissions. That said, I think, as Rob pointed out earlier, if you have three televisions in a house instead of one, it doesn't really end up mattering that they're very fuel efficient. And if you have, 100 flights instead of 20 that you had 5 years ago or 10 years ago, then you're going to have more greenhouse gas emissions. And that, in the aviation industry has been pursuing basically this package of approaches, which includes not only increase their own fuel efficiency, support air traffic control improvements that can get 10 to 15% savings in greenhouse gas because there's so much inefficiency in both the European system, the U.S. system, and the worldwide system, but also some airlines are coming along with market-based measures, whether it's supporting emissions trading, whether it is adopting offset programs that they either do themselves or allow their customers to do and offset their emissions. So in my view, a sector like that, there is no single answer. I guess I would add one more thing. A lot of folks have talked about research and development. That has to continue. The United States in particular has cut back its R&D in aeronautics incredibly over the last, over the Bush administration, to be blunt. And we're not investing in the type of technology that will see revolutionary changes. So we need to do that.
Thanks. And hopefully, as a follow-up, industry itself will be investing in R&D because they're going to realize the opportunity. This has spurred
It's a public-private partnership. And I should note, when we talk about air traffic control improvements, industry has to make huge investments to be able to realize those. So it's not asking government for a handout.
Please.
But when cities develop
Okay. Well, it's a big debate, and talking about targets is to the developing countries. If we get hung up on that, it can go on forever. And equity matters are such that somebody could say, well, per capita, greenhouse gas emission. How does that sound? If you're talking about equity, then I think the approach that we are pushing is that even if Kyoto is implemented, now Kyoto is almost over, or the son of Kyoto, we are still not going to stabilize. I mean, if you look at the emissions in the business as usual and with Kyoto, there's a little bit of dip. It's not a big deal. It's not a big difference. So there has to be other measures. How can you encourage them by taking action first and then helping them identify and show them the way? If you, and there are advocates, there are industries, businesses, and other groups that claim that they can show the way of a win-win opportunity. So why don't we start talking from there rather than getting hung up on you also accept targets and then we'll do when you do more.
A short answer to the hub and spoke question: yes, I think more and more airlines have been doing more point-to-point service. It's more fuel efficient and reduces emissions. The issue is, though, the entire infrastructure of the aviation industry was built up around the hub and spoke, and so it's really taking sort of a decommissioning kind of approach to get to that aspect of changing the industry.
Thanks.
We have time for just one more question, and then the chair might throw out a question as well because I'm sitting here with the microphone. So, William.
I think you're referring to the fund that was agreed to go forward on adaptation. And the adaptation fund is meant for countries that have difficulties dealing with climate change. It's sort of a basic fact that the poorest countries, the poorest communities have the most difficulty addressing severe weather change, severe weather events. And what had been in place for a number of years through the Clean Development Mechanism was that each project that I referred to that takes place under the CDM would have a 2% levy, and the 2% levy would go into this adaptation fund. In Nairobi, the Conference of the Parties agreed that they would accept invitations from any interested entities that wanted to administer that fund, and the GEF submitted an application to be that. But the big issue on adaptation is that these costs are going to continue to go up as sea level rise and severity of weather increases. $200 million does not buy you a lot of protection to deal with adaptation. And at this point, the only financial incentive to contribute to the adaptation fund is through these projects in the Clean Development Mechanism, which at this point runs out in 2012. So the international community needs to find a better means for developing incentives to deal with these needs, whether it's weather insurance and providing subsidies for that. Something needs to be done to address that issue. So it's a very serious issue going forward. We're doing a lot in terms of trying to deal with weather prediction, mitigation measures, but in the long run, it's going to be a serious issue.
Thanks a lot, Charles. One final little parting thought here is that we're talking about a lot of different systems playing together. The countries that manage these systems have very different levels of sophistication, the way they can assure compliance, verify results, whether or not you're talking within Europe, where you have economies that are fully developed and those that are in transition. The ability to assure the credibility of these systems are variable. When you bring in the developing world, how do we, as a collective community, assure that what is being generated as a carbon asset is really a ton in every one of these programs, in these systems, so that we do achieve the environmental results that these systems are designed to achieve. So we won't debate this, but I want you all to kind of just take that away and try to think how we can learn about building higher levels of integrity as a collective community here. So I really would like to thank all of our panelists today for really putting a rich discussion. Wish we had more time to continue this discussion while we have the experts here up, and just really appreciate it.
Thank you.
I think before we leave, the SDLP team would like to make an announcement.
On behalf of the Sustainable Development Law and Policy Journal, I'd like to thank everyone who helped plan and organize this essential conversation on the current and emerging climate change laws from both a domestic and global perspective. Specifically, I would like to thank Jennifer Dobson, as well as all our SDLP advisors, especially Professor David Hunter and Ken Markowitz, for moderating today's panels. I would also like to just thank our distinguished panelists for taking the time to participate in today's discussions. Finally, I'd like to thank all of you who are here today for your valuable contributions to our symposium. I would also like to take a moment to introduce the upcoming Sustainable Development Law and Policy issue on sustainable energy. The issue will cover everything from renewable fuels to green buildings to renewable portfolio standards for domestic energy. It will be available this May. Additionally, the second annual International SDLP Yearbook in both French and Spanish will also be available this spring.
Sweet. I want to remind everybody that there's a reception following this immediately outside. And we also want to tell everyone that if you're interested in seeing the podcast or getting any of the speakers' PowerPoints, it'll be available on the SDLP website. And the address of that is on the front cover of the latest issue, which you should all take home. So thank you very much. One more round.